and welcome to On the Money, where you can find out anything and everything to do with finance, business, and the economy. On the Money is broadcast live from the studios of Radio 2SER in Sydney, nationwide on the Community Radio Network. I'm Roderick Chambers, and coming up on the program this week...
It was a great shock to me when Melbourne University Press, after a great deal of enthusiasm, declined to publish my book.
Sturt University's Professor Clive Hamilton has been researching the amount of influence China may have on our investment in universities, businesses, and real estate. Yet when it came to publishing his book, he found that many publishers were concerned that they may suffer themselves economically if they publish a book critical to the China of the Chinese Communist government. Also on the show...
Some people would say it's just rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic as it slowly sinks into the ocean.
Yes, it's the last instalment of our story on the development of the discipline of economics, which takes us right up to today with some surprising revelations. All this and more coming up on The Money. But first, over the past week, the Transport Workers Union has begun a campaign to have rideshare workers associated with food apps like Deliveroo and Uber Eats covered under the Food Delivery Worker Award that covers other workers such as pizza delivery drivers. Currently, they're treated as separate contractors and as such do not have the same benefits as employees. Kevin Suarez asked National Secretary of the Transport Workers Union, Anthony Sheldon, what the rideshare food delivery drivers were actually entitled to.
There's a combination of things. You've got riders on their bikes that are entitled and very clearly employees. And there's massive wage theft being carried out by Deliveroo, Foodora and Uber Eats. You know, they are stealing millions upon millions of dollars from very hard-working home delivery workers, and it's horrific to see overseas students being exploited, Australian nationals. To think that people are coming to this country to be treated like second-class, third-class, if there was a fourth class, I think this would fall into the category, citizens in this country is appalling. And you've got then, of course, people on bikes, which are motorbikes, which are often receiving such poor conditions, and all of them getting paid well below minimum standards of awards, many of them not getting paid workers' compensation, certainly not sick leave, and certainly many of them relying on it as their only means of income per week.
That's a massive shame. So how are these companies able to get away with that?
Well, there's a combination of things. That there's the companies rely on one high turnover of staff, and even though there is a core group of steady riders, they certainly flaunt in the law because, you know, frankly, many of these people aren't unionised and they're only now becoming aware of their rights. Of course, that's something that these companies, Deliveroo, Foodora and Uber Eats, have been preying on.
Okay, so what would they get if they were considered employees rather than contractors?
Well, in a survey of 160 riders that we've carried out over a two-week period just last month, over 3 out of 4 were being paid below the standard award. And many of them, of course, have either experienced, over half of either experienced or had very close friends experience serious injuries that have left them off work without compensation, without pay, and certainly when their equipment is damaged without compensation for their capital they've put into and this equipment they've put into the work.
Okay, so what was the catalyst? Was there any sort of specific catalyst for this push for the app-associated food couriers to be awarded as employees?
Well, there's been a push certainly in various parts of the world and in Australia. You know, many people are rightly turning their attention to these high areas of exploitation from these big multinationals. It's not surprising. A lot of these app companies, white guys in their 30s wearing sand shoes and open neck shirts, and the billionaires preying on working people and is part of the on-demand economy, paying them per job rather than giving them what has been standards, you know, that is, the community has demanded over the last 100 years. You know, they've sort of got that, you know, unfortunate phrase, they call it the new economy. Well, I think it's more like the 18th century economy, where people don't have rights, certainly in the mind of these billionaires, and where the rights do exist, they do everything they can to avoid meeting their obligations.
So you mentioned earlier that there's been a massive push around the rest of the world. I was looking up in Britain, and that's one of the countries where they have been considering also a similar push to what your union is currently demanding. So what has been the reaction around the world? Has there been any progress on this?
Well, I think certainly, as you rightly said, and there's been a push by the Labour Party in the UK, but also a lot of community groups, and including, most importantly, you know, gig economy workers themselves. And to that effect, Meg Brown, who's involved in organising Deliveroo workers in London, was with us last week when we formally launched the campaign for rights for many of these workers doing these home deliveries. There is certainly cases with Uber drivers, passenger vehicles, significant decisions in the UK, certainly in California and in Seattle. And, of course, you won't be surprised to hear that all your listeners, that Uber is spending many millions of dollars on trying to keep drivers from joining unions, from coming together. And, of course, all that's bent about making sure they don't have a voice and be able to gain rights.
Right, yeah, well, evidently that hasn't quite worked out with rideshare workers, United, I think, currently being on the scene in the US and Australia as well. But regarding these riders, what has been the feedback from them regarding this campaign? Was there anything that they wanted most specifically?
Well, we've, you know, reached out to riders to hear what is particularly what they see as being the sorts of work that they want and sort of compensation. Now, many of them are very frustrated with no payment for waiting time, but also finding that many of the riders, you know, see the basic compensation when they're sick and injured work, and of course, you know, compensation for what can be very expensive equipment that somebody on any income, let alone on a low income, to provide. People will look at a bike and might think of, you know, a hand-me-down from their folks. Well, the bikes many of these riders are using, you know, have to be quality, well-maintained, and are expensive when you're on a very low income, I mean, and it's certainly expensive on any income. So those are the sorts of things that they want, and saying that things that should be rectified, that's, you know, these companies are making substantial profits for themselves, and, you know, they're putting lots of money in their executive pockets, and they should be sharing it with the riders, and rather than being those riders just being simply treated as a gig and on demand, they should be treated with respect and dignity.
Okay, and so one final question. So how are you currently appealing for the government to take note of this issue?
Well, we've reached out to the government on both nationally and state governments. Just last week, the Victorian Minister for Industrial Relations, at the launch for rights of gig workers and home delivery workers, spoke very passionately about those rights need to be enshrined in laws. Also has allocated resources from over the last 12 months in looking at people working in the field to talk to people that are being exploited in these sorts of jobs. We've reached out to the Australian Labor Party, very importantly, and at various conferences for the Australian Labor Party across the country, including the National Conference later this year. We're calling on the Labor Party to formally announce its support through its various congresses and conferences for gig workers to have rights and the future of work to have rights, because this is actually about everybody's job. It's certainly exemplified by what's happening with the exploitation of home workers getting paid so poorly, but it's also a prime example of what's happening across the economy as these app-based companies implement 18th century working standards.
National Secretary of the Transport Workers Union Tony Sheldon there, ending that report by Kevin Suarez. And you're listening to On The Money, finding out everything to do with money, finance and business. And we're broadcasting around Australia on the Community Radio Network from the studios of Radio 2 SER in Sydney. I'm Roderick Chambers.
Please explain. Please explain.
Yes, yeah, so now for the final of our Please Explain mini-series on macroeconomics, here's Veronica Alashina and Professor Frank Stillwell.
It wasn't inevitable that we would embrace the US model rather than the Swedish model. We could have gone the other way. A political choice, essentially.
Yeah. Well, do you think that there is an opportunity for that to be reversed, or is...
Yeah, it's never all over.
That makes me a bit more hopeful.
Yeah. I mean, economic systems aren't God-given, they're man-made or human-made, and if enough people want to forge a different future, it can be done.
Supply and demand, bubbles and recessions, GDP and FDI. These are just some of the topics dominating our current discourse about economics. But how are these ideas connected, and where did they come from? Welcome to the final episode of the Conversation About Macroeconomics with Professor Frank Stillwell, where we discuss the future of economics.
I think we have to recognise that despite the great ideas of more than 200 years of economic thought, developed by highly intelligent people to try to understand a complex world, we're still in a pretty poor shape in the 21st century. We haven't really got a coherent analysis of how the economy works, let alone a good set of guidelines for how it should work better. And that latter challenge, I'm hopeful, will drive new bodies of economic analysis and economic policy.
What are the issues facing our economic system today?
Think about it. Economic security. People are often trying to juggle two or three different jobs. They don't know if they're in casual employment, whether they'll have work next week. And on a macroeconomic level, we don't know if there's going to be another global financial crash next week. Secondly, there's a huge problem of economic inequality. Even though we've had a couple of centuries of economic growth, even here in Australia, we've got dramatic inequalities between a wealthy elite and people who are marginalised and on Struggle Street, sometimes associated with gender, with race, as well as class. And then thirdly, there's the huge challenge of sustainability. I mean, a growth-oriented economy simply is not sustainable in a world of finite resources.
What does an economic system that addresses these issues look like?
Secure, equitable and sustainable. I actually don't think that's going to be a capitalist economy as it's been historically understood. I think we're talking, therefore, not just about understanding capitalism, we're talking about transforming capitalism. And I think that's where modern political economy is focused.
I asked Professor Stillwell about a few emerging economic theories, like behavioural economics, for example.
Behavioural economics has really emerged out of neoclassical economics. The behavioural economists say, well, perhaps one of the problems with mainstream thinking is that it's got a rather naive view of humans as rational economic agents. If you observe people's shopping behaviour, if they observe their decision-making behaviour more generally, you can see we're all creatures of habit. We're motivated by questions of sort of social status and even by the context in which we're offered choices. And they say, well, let's just try to see the implications of making economics more realistic by importing ideas from psychology. Somewhat paradoxically, the notion of the ultra-rational economic person is still at the core of that thinking. So if you ask what follows from behavioural economics, it's typically a policy of nudging people. Some governments around the world have even set up nudge departments to try to use behavioural economics to make people more rational in offering the choice between, say, public transport modes. Let's look into the research about why people choose to go by train or by bus, and we'll nudge them into the forms of behaviour that we think they ought to be doing. Some people would say it's just rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic as it slowly sinks into the ocean.
Are there any alternatives to behavioralism? Anything that's emerging that you find particularly interesting or optimistic?
Well, I think again, one can't resolve these problems purely in the realm of economic theory. You've got to think about, well, how do those ideas relate to changing the world in reality? And the experience of some of those Scandinavian or Nordic nations is, I think, relevant here.
The Nordic countries have been very involved in experimentation with the concept of the universal basic income.
Well, I think it's a great idea, a great example of this space between capitalism and socialism where you can perhaps get the best of both worlds. We live in a very productive economy. Don't believe what some of our political leaders say about the need to crank up productivity. By historical standards, we're fantastic. And what basic income does is says, well, let's get rid of poverty. Let's give everyone a slice of the action, irrespective of what work they do or even whether they work. In an affluent society, you provide an income floor. No one falls below it. That should help social cohesion. It might have some damaging effects on the incentive to work for people who think, oh, you know, if I can get $20,000 a year from the government, then I don't need to work. But the trials that have been done so far tend to suggest that that fear is somewhat overplayed and that most people would still work, either because they want extra income over and above that basic, and or because they actually find work interesting. It creates social networks, it gives some purpose, some status in society. Not to say that this is a totally unproblematic foreign policy. It would be expensive and it does have some uncertain consequences, but it's certainly a good example of the thinking that needs to be done about economic and social reform in the current era. Drawing on Marxism, on neoclassical economics, on Keynesian economics, and on feminist economics, environmental ideas too, to try to build a new synthesis that doesn't just help us to understand the world, actually gives us some principles for changing it for the better. I think this can be done.
A huge thank you to Professor Frank Stilwell for taking part in this Please Explain miniseries for On the Money, produced at the studios of Radio 2SER. All episodes can be found on our website, www.2ser.com/onthemoney. Remember, if you have any questions about business, money, finance, or the economy, send them to us on Twitter. Look for @onthemoney2ser.
Yes, Veronica Alashina there with our season finale of the Please Explain on Macroeconomics with Emeritus Professor Frank Stilwell from the University of Sydney. Well, earlier in the week, National Security Committee Chair and Liberal MP Andrew Hastie and Labor Deputy Chair Anthony Byrne were both preparing to provide some parliamentary protection for Professor Clive Hamilton's new book on the influence of China. I asked Professor Hamilton what his reaction was when Melbourne University Press told him that they were withdrawing from republishing his book.
It was a great shock to me when Melbourne University Press, after a great deal of enthusiasm, declined to publish my book.
What sort of proportion of students are actually coming from China? Is that the reason that universities are particularly touchy on this sort of subject?
Universities are very sensitive to the huge amounts of funding they derive from Chinese students. For some of them, it's 15 to 20% of their entire income stream. Plus, there are large numbers of research and teaching agreements they have with universities in China, which provides another source of cash. And unfortunately, nowadays, universities think like corporations, and so the bottom line, rather than basic principles of academic freedom, are dominant in their thinking.
One of the big exporters, according to many of our economists, is the academic output, and appears to be a lot of that is being derived from China. So given that China is our biggest trading partner, how critical of China can we be without affecting some of our economic interests?
Well, in my view, we should be allowed to say what we need to say without thinking about our trade relationship. I mean, don't democratic rights and our sovereignty as a nation come before our trading relationships? Aren't they kind of, you know, principles that we hold dear to our hearts as Australians, and we're not willing to give them up because Beijing threatens to, you know, take away some students or some tourist flows. That's what Beijing does. It engages in what's sometimes known as geoeconomics, which is basically economic blackmail, which it's used in a very aggressive way against Taiwan and Japan and indeed South Korea. And I think it's only a matter of time before Beijing attempts to blackmail Australia into taking a political or strategic decision in favour of Beijing by taking away some economic benefit. And I think that will be an absolute test case of whether we Australians believe in democratic rights or whether we're willing to sell them off.
Well, we haven't actually signed up to the One Belt, One Road initiative. Do you think we'll end up getting coerced into signing onto that particular project of the Chinese government?
Well, the Turnbull government, to its credit, has said, no, we're not going to sign up to that because we don't really know what it is. There's a lot of evidence around suggesting that One Belt, One Road is actually a way of China gaining strategic influence over the countries that allow it to penetrate.
The
Labor Party is more worrying because the Labor Party is making very ambivalent noises about it. So I hope that they will, if they attain government this year or early next, will listen to the intelligence briefings and say, no, we shouldn't go near that.
It does sound a bit like that it is the way to take over the world trade or the transportation of world trade, considering that, the greater part of world trade is to and from China. Is that really all it is?
Oh, no, it's much more than that. Beijing is extremely sensitive about criticism of its human rights record, and for good reason, because its human rights record is appalling and getting worse. Everything from throwing in jail lawyers who defend clients who have been persecuted in China to the forced removal of organs from Falun Gong practitioners to severe restrictions on free speech in China. The European Union has typically led international criticism of China's human rights record. Beijing or China has invested heavily in Greece in recent years, buying the port of Piraeus, making large loans for infrastructure investments in Greece. Greece, of course, is suffering. And now Greece, last year, refused to endorse the EU dialogue with China over human rights abuses. And as a result, because the EU operates on a you need unanimous agreement, had to abandon its human rights dialogue with China because Greece refused to participate. And Greece refused to participate because they'd been bought off by China. So this is how they operate. Countries become dependent, politicians become beholden, the business community becomes an apologist for China, and the nation capitulates on matters of principle.
So as far as the influence goes in our own region, China do seem to have been taking a lot of interest in smaller South Pacific nations. What would be our defence against that sort of incursion sort of through the back door in a way?
Well, there are a number of implications here. One is that China has made it plain to some of those small island states that in exchange for the investments in infrastructure, whether gifts or loans in those states, they expect those states to vote for China in the United Nations. The second is that by establishing influence in those nations, they win them over to Beijing's point of view and enable it to exert influence across the Pacific. I mean, they, the Western Pacific Rim, and they could, in time, particularly if there was a Chinese military build-up in those islands, just as it is in the South China Sea, could be an important part of China's military resistance to the United States in the Pacific. The other thing is that the Pacific has traditionally been the geostrategic backyard of Australia and New Zealand. And so China, by gaining dominance there, is essentially gaining dominance in our backyard. And you might think, well, Samoa and Fiji, do we care that much? Actually, I do, but some might not. But what if it were PNG? What if China becomes the dominant geostrategic player in PNG? And you know, if we're projecting 15, 20 years forward, build a military base at Port Moresby. How do we feel about that?
That's Professor Hamilton there from Sturt University ending that report. You're listening to On the Money Around Australia on the Community Radio Network. And that's all we have for you on The Money this week. Tune in again next week to find out anything and everything you need to know about money, finance and business. Thanks to producers Kevin Suarez and Veronica Alashina. On The Money is produced in the studios of Radio 2SER for the Community Radio Network. You can find all their shows and stories at 2SER.com/onthemoney. You can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. Follow us on Twitter. Look for @onthemoney2SER. That's the number 2. And find us on Facebook. You can also ask us any questions you like on the Twitter handle there, @onthemoney2SER. I'm Roderick Chambers. We'll be back again next week to give you the inside running on all things financial. Thanks for your company.
Sydney Opera House, by arrangement with Handsome Tours, presents The National on the Opera House forecourt this February. In support of their critically acclaimed new release, Sleep Well Beast, and a career-spanning collection of visceral and slow-burning ballads, set your watch for a searing summer night by the harbour. The National, Opera House forecourt, February 21 and 22. Book now at sydneyoperahouse.com. Sponsors of 2SER.
Sydney's premier comedy night is here, and it's right in the heart of Newtown. Wayward's Comedy at the Bank showcases a range of local legends every Wednesday night, including Mike Goldstein, Cassie Workman, Eric Hutton, Neil Kolhatka, and plenty more during February. Just $10 online or on the door. For full lineups and more info, head to bankhotel.com.au. The Bank Hotel, proudly sponsoring 2SER 107.3.
You know the best thing in life is free.
You can give it to the birds and bees. I want some money. Yeah, yeah. I want some money. Yeah, yeah. You all will give me such a thrill. But you love me.